Chapter 7.
This can't be happening!
Frank Hardy yelled as he threw himself at the netting that entangled him. Just then, the room plunged into darkness again. Frank's brain shied away from the dreadful scene he'd just witnessed. The blood, the still form. He had failed Callie, and now she was dead. He was responsible. If he had insisted that she stay in Bayport, suddenly he was overwhelmed by anger. He had to find the people responsible for killing Callie. He would make them pay for what they had done. But first he had to escape. Using the largest blade of his pocket knife, he attacked the rubbery, sticky strands of the net that entrapped him. The strands resisted cutting. His blade sank halfway through, then three quarters of the way, and at long last, a strand finally snapped. Now on to strand number two. The process seemed to go on forever. Each second was an eternity to Frank. Eventually, he severed enough of the cords to make an opening large enough to wriggle through. He tore his way out of the net, then paused in the darkness, halfway between the door to the chamber and the gruesome torture rack in the middle of the room. One part of him wanted to rush over to Callie, to try something, anything, to save her. But a cold voice in his brain told Frank there was no help he could bring Callie. The blow of that monstrous blade had killed her instantly. Still, I should go to her, Frank thought. Then his hands began to shake. Do I really want to see her this way? Do I even know it's safe to go over there? Maybe whoever created this little horror show is depending on that. Maybe another, more sinister booby trap is waiting to be sprung in the darkness over there. Frank made up his mind and headed for the door. When he returned to this room, he'd bring help, official help, to nail the twisted sadists responsible for all this. And when I get them, Frank vowed, they'll wish they'd never started to play this game. They'd wish they'd never been born. Frank found the door and stumbled down the stone hallway in near pitch darkness, feeling his way. He was afraid to use his flashlight. He didn't want to make a target of himself. As he forged his way down the narrow blacked corridor, Frank did his best to concentrate on escape. There were so many ways he could trigger another trap. Pressure plates, tripwires, even undetectable electronic eyes. He had no choice but to go on. Carefully, slowly, he crept up the steps to the main corridors. Once on the first floor, he kept his right hand on the moldy stone wall and moved ahead, retracing the twists and turns he'd taken. At last, he reached the outer reception chamber, lit by gleaming moonlight streaming in through the barred windows. Heart-pounding, Frank ran for the massive iron-banded wooden door, which still stood ajar. He dashed across the overgrown lawn to the gravel road. His rental car was still there. A thought flitted across Frank's mind. Should he check under the hood for any unexpected extras? What if whoever killed Callie had planted a bomb? Frank lifted the hood and quickly scanned the engine. Nothing. Then he slammed the hood shut. Now was not the time to hang around.
Right.
A little voice mocked him from a corner of his mind. Run away from it all. I am not running from, Frank thought. I'm running to get help. The only problem was, help was so far away. Frank threw the car door open, got behind the wheel, and started the engine. The old car roared to life. Frank took it through a wild turn, skidding on fallen leaves and gravel as he pulled away. Through the rearview mirror, he could see the ruins of the old madhouse eerily lit by the beams of a huge, orange, looming moon. Frank didn't even need the headlights until he reached the line of trees. A ground mist was rising from among the trees, creating ghostly forms that swept across the narrow roadway. To Frank's imagination, they looked like Callie. There was Callie giving him a mischievous grin. He took a turn, and there was Callie again, her eyes wide with excitement. Another turn, and he almost swerved into a tree. There was Callie. Dead. Butchered. Frank floored the gas pedal, fleeing even faster through the haunted woods. Joe always told me there was no way I could really understand how he felt after Iola died. Frank's lips were tight. His eyes burned with unshed tears. Now I see he was right.
Oh, Callie, he thought. I never should have listened to you. I should have never let you convince me. I should never have brought you here.
In Bayport, Joe Hardy's thoughts were on his mother as he drove to the police station. Mom tried to comfort me when Vanessa died, and I pushed her away.
She went off to the store, and I never had a chance to talk to her again.
He clenched his teeth together tightly, struggling to keep from crying as he drove. The residential section was still full of life. He braked to a screeching stop as a pack of older trick-or-treaters skittered across in front of him, looking like a collection of brightly colored leaves in his headlights. It was almost 9 o'clock, past bedtime for the really little ones, but the older kids were out in full force, up for any kind of prank. As he drove on, an egg whizzed across the street just in front of his windshield. At another corner, two boys were squirting shaving cream on each other. The closer he got to the downtown district, the less activity there was. At least they're not stupid enough to try any nonsense in front of police headquarters, he thought, pulling the van up in front of the building. Joe took a deep breath, trying to calm himself. It wouldn't help to go in there raving like a maniac, he told himself. We'll just waste time while I convince them I'm telling the truth. Con Riley was sitting behind the front desk. He had the phone to his ear and a harassed expression on his face.
You say they're TPing the house next door? We'll send a car around.
He rubbed a large hand over his square jaw, then got on the intercom.
More toilet paper terrorists,
he said, giving an address. Then Con looked up and saw Joe.
Besides this juvenile crime wave, I've gotten 3 reports of Frankenstein roaming the streets and a lot of giggling telephone pranks. One of these days, we'll have an automatic tracing on this line, and a lot of snotty little kids will live to regret it.
Then Con remembered what had happened to Joe.
I'm sorry,
the policeman said.
The lab boys still haven't had a chance to get to those candles.
Con's expression changed as he looked more closely at Joe.
Is there something more, Joe?
Con asked.
What's the matter?
Murder!
Joe got the word out.
My mother! I found her in the attic!
What?
The officer's face registered his surprise.
Isn't your mother supposed to be in New York? That's where your dad said they'd be when I bumped into him the other day.
She came home this afternoon,
Joe said.
Some kind of bug.
The story poured out of him. Con got on the intercom and made some arrangements.
If you don't mind, I'll be going on this call personally. I'd like Horvath to go along with me.
Joe followed the police car back to Elm Street. The closer they came to the Hardy house, however, the harder Joe found it to breathe. The squad car pulled into the driveway, and Joe parked the van on the street. Con and the young police officer, Andy Horvath, waited as Joe came up to join them. All the lights were still out. Officer Riley tested the doorknob.
Locked!
I did that on the way out,
Joe said.
So no one would disturb the evidence.
He slipped his key in, and the door swung open. Con's partner reached in, sweeping his hand over the light switch. Immediately, the light clicked on.
I thought you said the lights weren't working,
the young officer said.
They weren't,
Joe said.
None of them went on.
They went slowly from room to room, checking the lamps. All of them lit.
The crime scene is upstairs, correct?
Joe caught an odd tone in Con's voice as he said that.
Yes, in the attic. I heard a whole music box of my grandmother's and followed the sound up.
Silently, Con led the way upstairs. They paused at the attic door. Con turned the knob with care, then stepped inside. Joe couldn't bring himself to confront that scene again. He stood at the bottom of the attic stairs, unable to go up and look inside. A moment later, Officer Horvath emerged, followed by Con Riley. Horvath's voice was serious as he said,
You ought to know that on Halloween there's always a tremendous drain on the department because of pranks.
What were they going to tell him? Joe wondered. That he'd have hours to wait before the crime scene crew would arrive? How could he stand to stay there under this roof, knowing what was up there? The young officer's features darkened as he walked down the attic stairs.
But to call us out on a phony baloney murder case!
He broke off.
Pal, you've got a lot of nerve, and I'm going to make sure you explain that to a judge!
At that moment, Con Riley grabbed the other policeman by the arm and whispered something in his ear. For a second, Officer Horvath looked as if he wanted to give Con Riley an argument. Then he shrugged.
Joe,
Con said quietly.
I know what happened this afternoon. Must have been a shock for you. And I really wish that your older brother hadn't been called away on business.
The officer kept his voice low and soothing.
Maybe you should try and get some rest.
Rest?
Joe said, his voice rising a little wildly.
How do you expect me to rest with my girlfriend killed and my mother?
I think you should rest,
Con said more forcefully.
And no more calls. There are others who take a dimmer view of all this.
A dimmer view of murder?
Joe echoed furiously. He raced up the stairs into the attic and froze. Under the wan glow of the single electric light, the attic room was a lot less shadowy. There was the usual bric-a-brac, a few ancient trunks, and the rocking chair, thick with dust. But there was no trace of blood, a knife, or Joe's mother. End of chapter.